Hi, folks. I'm Marty Rabin with the group Shenandoah, and you're listening to my buddy Thomas Mooney right here on the Neon Eon.
The Neon Eon is exclusively presented with limited interruption by Burn Vodka. The award-winning vodka is a product of the Panhandle Plains of West Texas. While Burn Vodka is still a new and fresh brand within the world of spirits and vodka, it was initially formulated in the heart of the Lubbock, Texas music scene and was first introduced at the Blue Light Live, where it soon became a signature shot demanded by musicians, Blue Light loyalists, and newcomers all the same. Now, what is Burn Vodka? It's a habanero-flavored vodka that has just the right kick and a smooth, delayed heat that leaves you desiring more. Again, ask any band who has graced the Blue Light stage their thoughts on the signature shot and watch their eyes light up. It's like a secret handshake, and I guarantee you'll get a story or two out of them about the legendary venue and storied Burn Vodka shot. Head on over to theburnvodka.com for more information such as where to find Burn Vodka, merchandise such as caps and t-shirts, and the all-too-important recipe corner. Currently, Burn Vodka is available primarily here in Texas, but is rapidly expanding to the shelves of your local watering hole and liquor store. Again, that's theburnvodka.com. I'll have links to the website in the show notes, as well as where to follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Hey y'all, welcome back to the Neon Eon, your favorite podcast about 90s country music. Hopefully that is. I'm your host, music journalist Thomas Mooney, and as you heard up top, this week's guest is Marty Rabin of Shenandoah. This one right here with Marty was an absolute joy. Here on the Neon Eon, I often talk about how these songs and these artists, they're such an integral part of my upbringing, which I'm assuming for most folks who are listening, they're a giant part of yours as well. But you know, part of that is because country music was simply inescapable for someone like me growing up. That's obviously not the case for everyone. There's going to be some who just don't have those same memories or the nostalgia or attachment to these songs because it just wasn't around. It's very, very understandable. I say all that because, let's just be honest, Shenandoah is a little bit different. Specifically, a song like Two Dozen Roses, it just transcends country music. That song just becomes a part of the American lexicon. It's the same thing as apple pie, Coca-Cola, and Elvis. I pointed this out to Marty because I just find it really amazing and a little bit on the surreal side how they went from essentially being a local house band down in Muscle Shoals who'd be playing these country covers and staples and sneaking in some originals. They really cut their teeth on these country classics. But fast forward 35 years and every new country artist, if they're playing some 2 or 3 hour gig somewhere, I guarantee you Two Dozen Roses is on that set list, and at bare minimum, they can play it on request. Now, of course, we talk a lot more than just Two Dozen Roses on this one. We touch on those early Northern Alabama roots, some of those ballads like Ghosts in This House and Moon Over Georgia, hitting the road really, really hard early on during their heyday, disbanding and reforming, and of course, their new album, Every Road. Every Road is a very special project for Shenandoah. It's a collab album that features folks like Ashley McBride, Cody Johnson, Carly Pierce, Dierks Bentley, Blake Shelton, and many, many more. Again, it's one of those things where you're a hardworking band, you always kind of think of yourself that way. Fast forward 35 years later, and you know, you're a legendary band where all these artists who are modern contemporaries, they look up to you and they want to do collaborations with you. Now, before we kick it into high gear with Marty, let's do some jukebox upkeep. If this is your first time listening to the Neon Eon, I urge you to go ahead and hit that subscribe button. Now be a pal and tell all your buddies, friends, compadres, and acquaintances to do the exact same thing. While you're at it, head on over to the Neon Eon merch store. We finally have some stellar Neon Eon merchandise available. Currently, there's not one, but two different t-shirt designs, stickers, magnets, all that kind of stuff, those soft shell koozies, and also, probably my favorite item, the old school thick foam koozies. Anyway, yeah, they're all over there on the neoneon.bigcartel.com. Telling y'all, they're super slick, and yeah, you're gonna look really, really cool in a Neon Eon shirt. Also, I'm doing a cool kickoff special. If you order a t-shirt by Friday, I'll throw in one of those old school foam koozies for free. And as you'd guess, the Neon Eon is on all your favorite social media stuff like Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Go search for at the Neon Eon and give us a follow. Links for everything I just mentioned will be in the show notes for good measure. I think that's about it. Let's do it. Here's Marty Rabin of Shenandoah. I guess let's start off with, you know, early in your career, in y'all's career, as far as like those first records, I think maybe something that's maybe a little surprising for some folks is that, yeah, you guys came out like in this like late 80s, early 90s time, but y'all also had that connection to Muscle Shoals, and there has been so much music that has come out of that area. And of course, you worked with Rick Hall and Robert Byrne, who obviously produced those first two records with y'all. What was that like back then, as far as like coming out of that Muscle Shoals area and recording down there, where like all these amazing artists obviously also recorded?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, you know, see, I'm a Florida transplant, so you know, I had known about Muscle Shoals, and you know, and really, to be honest with you, it wasn't anything at an early age for me that had struck a nerve. It really was only until I got here in 1985 that that I really started, you know, learning about, you know, the guys, the Swampers. Mm-hmm. You know, those guys were coming to the club listening to this band that I joined up with because they needed a lead singer and a front guy to keep things going in a local club here. And so slowly but surely, you know, of course, some of the tunes that we would play would be, you know, circled around the, you know, the Muscle Shoals past, you know, the hits that that had been cut here, you know, through the years. And of course, the guy that we were working for wanted top 40 country music. So therefore, you know, and rock and roll as well, too. So therefore, we literally had to cover the whole gamut. So therefore, while being here and then starting to write a little bit with some of the writers down here, and to hear things mentioned, I'd get curious about, well, I keep hearing this name. Surely I need to look this guy up or find out exactly, have a conversation with somebody and find out exactly who this person is. Because if you were, you know, Google wasn't around, you know, you couldn't Google anybody back then, you know. So it started dawning on me that the more and more that I was finding out, you know, I mean, literally just the more and more I was just amazed at literally what all had went on here. And anyway, so when we finally got a record deal, and it wasn't that we were trying to get one. It's just we were playing, you know, 2 miles down from Fame Recording Studio in a nightclub at Muscle Shoals. And everybody and his brother literally would come from literally all over Northeast Mississippi and Northwest Alabama, probably within a 150-mile radius. And I'm not kidding, over the weekend to come hear this band at the MGM. Because we literally had probably one of the most premier guitar players in Jim Seals. And Ralphie Zell, Lord, he was a session player that was known throughout, you know, Jackson, Mississippi, and over in Memphis, Tennessee, and then of course here in the show band, Nashville. So therefore, you know, I mean, it was a strong band, and so therefore, and then being able to sing, you know, in the band, everybody said, man, that's singing. I was doing everything in the world I could to keep up with them guys. You know, because, man, they were just playing. And so, therefore, that word got out, you know, that, man, they said, there's a killer band in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, at the MGM. Man, y'all need to go hear these guys. So the next thing you know, we were there one Saturday night, and a group from CBS Records came. And they claimed, said, man, are you the guys that write and work a little bit with Rick Hall? Well, of course, I wasn't a famed writer, but the guitar player and the drummer, Mike McGuire, that they were. So anyway, so with that as it is, I just said yeah, because you know we're on the band staying and playing and stuff, you know, folks want music to continue and stuff like that, and it really wasn't the time for a conversation. I said, that's us. So then they moved over to my left, which would be their right, over to Ralph, and started asking Ralph, you know, You know, so Ralph, you know, while I'm doing my thing, you know, Ralph's talking. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, this kind of thing. And so the next thing you know, Tommy Brassfield and Robert Byrne, literally, which was his songwriting royalty here in Muscle Shoals, came one Thursday night. And so it's ladies' night. And of course, you know, they're out there and they had been writing, you know, that day and stuff like that. So therefore, while writing and all that kind of stuff, they had decided what they would do was, man, they just come down here because Mike had invited, you know, them to come down and to be a part of the, you know, the festivities, you know. So, man, look, fellas, it's ladies' night. I don't know whether you want to go down and dance or anything like that, but, you know, it's ladies' night. You know, it's really kind of a slower night before the weekend picks up. So next thing you know, here's Tommy Brassfield and Robert Byrne sitting out there listening to us. And of course, you know, Once in a Blue Moon. And that was a close one. And in fact, No Getting Over Me that Tommy and Walt Aldridge had written. So therefore, I mean, that was tune after tune after tune. And of course, you know, just being, you know, just picking at them and not really being ugly to them, but, you know, picking at them, you know, they get you, what's in a blue moon? You know, and that's kind of like somebody yelling Freebird,
right?
You know, down here. So anyway, so yeah. We'll get to that in a minute. So what we were going to do was we were going to make them stay. You know, they wasn't just going to come in there and listen for a little bit and then leave. We was going to make them stay for a while. So, you know, they was wanting to hear a couple of their tunes. Mike said, man, we do Once in a Blue Moon and a couple of other things that y'all written. And so, really? Yeah, sure do. Well, man, maybe we need to come. So they did. And the next thing you know, then we take a break, you know, 45 on and 15 off. And so anyway, so they said, man, we've got a production deal going. Fame Studios has a production deal going on with CBS Records. We said, okay. And said, man, we have literally been traveling all over the country looking for a band. And would you guys consider, you know, us going in and cut some speculative sides and let's, you know, throwing it up to CBS and seeing what happened. I mean, I jumped all over that. Look, I left Florida to get a record deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, man, I'm in. And a couple of the guys in the band said, I don't know about that. And I said, no. Look, I'm in. And I said, man, these guys will be in too. And they, well, I don't know. Well, I said, no, yeah. And so anyway, so said, well, you know, we'll talk about it. So then the next thing you know, we were at Robert Byrne's house we were talking about, you know, the possibilities of doing this and what would we do? And from here on, this is what we need to do. We need to see what we can do about trying to find some tunes to cut. And the next thing you know, we were in the studio recording tunes. We cut seven of them. They brought them up to CBS. CBS fell in love with them. And then Rick Blackburn at that time was head of Columbia and decided to come see us. Well, in the meantime, before we had got the tracks even started and really cut, unfortunately, Tommy Brassfield had died. And so therefore, there was Robert to produce the record. And he approached us and said, look, fellas, you know, this deal actually is Rick Hall's, you know, it's Fame, you know, it's Fame. It's a Fame promotion deal. It's a Fame production company. I just think it would be smart if we got Rick involved in this. He certainly got the notoriety of the name recognition. Would you fellas be opposed if I asked Rick to be a part of this? And we said, no, it's fine. Because, I mean, look, we worked with Rick in one way or another. I had done some demos, some vocal demos for Rick. And therefore, I'd already worked with him in the studio. And then, you know, all the guys had, you know, had played. And, of course, Mike was a writer, you know, for Rick. And never played on any session, but he was one of Rick's writers. And Jim Seals was a writer and a player down at the studio when they have a demo session. So therefore, there was a lot of the nucleus there that made sense. And then of course Ralph living here in town, he had worked with Rick for years and years and years, so it just all made sense. And so therefore, the Muscle Shoals blending of what it was and I guess what we felt like we could make of it had all come together when those decisions were made, you know, to go in the studio and and to see what would happen. And next thing you know, it was brought to CBS. CBS was all over it. Like I said a while ago, and Rick Blackburn had literally loaded up. He chartered a bus and literally had brought 55 of the staff at Columbia Records in Nashville to come down one night and sit in front of the stage and watch us. And they did. I mean, they literally had to change the seating arrangement in the MGM where we played. They covered the dance floor up with chairs so that the CBS staff could listen. And of course, so, you know, we wanted to make it a big night and this kind of stuff. We're excited. Rick said, man, you better get all your friends to come. Then folks need to think y'all packed the joint. Well, we did pack the joint, but said, man, you better put, so we went to WLAY and put the word out and that kind of stuff. And because literally at that time, I mean, we were even looking for a name. You know, said, you know, CBS said, man, you guys better pick you out a name. You can't be called the MGM Band. So anyway, so all that went through. And so we had approached CBS, WLAY, and said, look, you know, here's what's happening. And went on the air, you know, with the personality, said, look, you know, this, man, we need y'all to come. It needs to look like we're all strong and united down here. And everybody loves the MGM Band. And, man, this is a big night. The big reps from CBS is coming. And, man, we need a good showing from the public, and I'm telling you, brother, you couldn't have cut fog in there with a straw. I mean, they was elbow to elbow. In fact, to be honest with you, I mean, people were complaining because the gals couldn't even get anybody anything to drink because, I mean, it was just a press. You know, I mean, just everybody's in there. And of course, when they changed the floor arrangement and stuff, and everybody's, you know, out by the side, I mean, it literally was. I mean, it was packed. I mean, literally, absolutely packed. And anyway, so at the end of the night, you know, Rick Blackburn, you know, walked up to us and said, fellas, y'all need to be on CBS Records, and I'm going to make that happen. And anyway, so the next thing you know, we got word that we needed to finish up them seven sides, and they released a couple of singles that really, honest and truly, didn't really go anywhere. It was They Don't Make Love Like We Used To. And then a tune called Stop the Rain, which I still today believe is a stone cold screaming smash. But, you know, at where we were and it being the sophomore single that we had, it didn't have there wasn't a track record of any success in our career at the time.
Right.
And so therefore, you know, looking and seeing, you know, whether these guys are going to hold water or not was not really the thing that, you know, that anybody was interested in. Our first record went to 58 and anchored. And then we went to 48 with Stop the Rain and it anchored. And we thought, well, you know, hey, you know, it's 48. It's, you know, it's better, you know, it falling at 58. You know, at least we're moving up, you know, that kind of thing. And then all of a sudden we come with a tune that Robert Byrne and Will Robbins had wrote called She Doesn't Cry Anymore. And so we put that out, and next thing you know, man, it started getting a little traction. And then it started getting more traction. You got to think, hey, we're in the top 40 here. And the next thing you know, we literally had a top 10 record with it. It stopped at number 9. And anyway, so at that time, we literally, you know, could even announce that we legitimately were a hit singles band. And anyway, so we were traveling across the country. We were in Salt Lake City, Utah, when we got the word that it went top 10. It went to number 9. And then they said, fellas, we're going to lose it there at 9. And, man, I mean, we were so tickled. Man, we got a top 10 record, fellas. Man, this is unbelievable. We got a top 10 record. And so the next thing you know, we released Mama Knows, and it went to number 4. And then after Mama Knows, we released Church on Cumberland Road, and it stayed at number 1 for 2 weeks in a row. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time that ever a self-contained band had ever had their first number 1 record to stay number 1 for 2 weeks. And then from there, then after that, we came with Sunday in the South. And then by the time we got to Two Dozen Roses, it was over. I mean, it was Katy barred the door then. I mean, we were wide open. And, you know, such tunes as Next to You, Next to Me, and a ghost in this house, and then I got you, and when you were mine, it was a wonderful time. It really was.
Yeah, it's amazing how, as you mentioned, there, like those first couple singles, you know, they peak at in the 40s, 50s, and then once you end up like getting that top 10 hit, all that momentum just builds up, and all from there, like you have like the, you know, like the buzz, you have like the trust of like a fan base outside of like your pocket, and they trust you as far as knowing like, oh, these guys are going to be delivering hits. And it's amazing how like kind of like that momentum builds, because obviously you went from top 10 to, you know, having that number one single and like that a run of number one singles right off the soon thereafter. So, I mean, it's amazing how like that momentum builds up.
Yeah, five consecutive number one records in a row. I mean, you know, it was just it was wild. But, you know, and I, Thomas, I'll even tell you this, you know, we had actually had got to the point, and listen, it wasn't an arrogant thing whatsoever. I promise you it wasn't, but we had got to the point of, you know, man, we got to thinking, man, at five number one records in a row, Jiminy Christmas. And then all of a sudden, you know, we didn't realize what five number one records in a row meant. I mean, we've seen the crowds build and all that other kind of stuff, and seen the sellouts one after another and stuff, and that type stuff. And then all of a sudden, then we went out in 1990 on tour with Randy Travis, and we opened for Randy. And then we added to the show. It actually was the GMC Country Showdown tour. And it was Randy Travis, Tammy Wynette, and Shenandoah. And then when Tammy couldn't make some of the shows, they hired some little old fella just come along by the name of Alan Jackson. And then when Alan couldn't do it, Ricky Van Shelton came out and did it. And then Shelby Lynn came out and done some dates with us as well, too. So it was always a three-act night. And whether it was just two or three, and if it was just two or three when we first started, they wanted us to do 30 dates with them. And then once we did the 30 dates, it literally was so successful that what they did was is they in turn said, look, we want to buy 30 more dates from you. So, you know, they worked all that out with the booking agency and stuff like that, and secured the 30 more dates. And then we eased in some other, because the sales of the show was so good that we wound up actually working 70 days, you know, 70 shows with Randy. And in those six, so what I'm talking about is they started booking matinees. So in other words, if you didn't get the ticket right away, then the sales of this is going on, and another 8,000 seats were going to be opened up for a 4 o'clock show that evening. And then the 7 o'clock, eight o'clock show, you know, and that normally happened with us and Randy. And so therefore, with that being successful, then they wanted the other 30 dates. So anyway, so on top of that, we did that. And I mean, we literally were hotter than a firecracker. And during this time, we'd already had some rumblings with some folks that started in 89 over the name Shenandoah. And only to find out that Rick Hall and Fame Production and CBS Records never did a trademark search on the name Shenandoah. They never did. And so therefore, you know, there was, you know, lawsuit after lawsuit. You know, we went through three of those. Mm-hmm. We literally, you know, here we are sitting on top of the world, got everything in the world going for you. You couldn't think of anything in the better in the world going on for you in your life than you having something like this going on. And the whole time you're being in a barrage of lawsuits, because people could literally prove in a court of law that they had the name before we did. So therefore, you know, we got attorneys doing this, got attorneys doing that. We got this going on, that going on. And just an absolute mess. I mean, you know, it just really honest and truly was a really, really aggravating thing. So we're trying to settle with them. And we said, look, we went to CBS and we went to Rick Hall and said, look, just help us. Help us pay these lawsuits. Help us pay these attorneys. And Rick said, I'm not doing that. That's not my problem. Yes, it is. You and the label gave us the name. You know, y'all are the ones that didn't do a trademark search. You know, what we wanted to call ourselves, y'all didn't want us to call. Mm-hmm. You know, y'all wanted us to be called Shenandoah. Y'all are the ones that gave us the name. Surely you could help us. Now, we're not asking you to pay all of it. But, you know, we do need you to pay some of it. You know, look, just pay a third. We'll pay a third. And then CBS will pay a third. I'm not doing it. So, therefore, we had to file Chapter 11. And so when we filed Chapter 11, what that meant was is every contract that we were on, that we had signed, our names at that time became null and void. So, therefore, we were no longer signed with CBS. We were no longer signed with Rick Hall. We were no longer signed with management. We were no longer signed with anybody. You know, I mean, it null and void everything. And anyway, so then the label says, well, you know, y'all did that on purpose to get out of your record deal. You know, and we're thinking, get out of our record deal. We wanted you to help us. You know, that's what we wanted. And then the record label says, no, you did that to get out of your record deal, so we're going to sue you. So then the record label sued us. You know, so anyway, so before it was all over, we had, you know, we learned a very, very valuable lesson. That was that who we could count on literally was the five of us. We all knew that each one of us could count on each other. And that's pretty much where it was. And really, to be honest with you, I think that only made the music that much stronger. Because from that point, we had signed with, after all this had cleared, RCA picked us up. And we did a long time coming album for RCA. And then when we were kind of getting seated into that, we cut one of the best records I think we ever cut. The two best records I think we ever did was The Road Not Taken and Under the Kudzu. I think was the two best records that we've ever done as far as my preference. Now, everybody in the band certainly could have had a different thought about that, but that was my preference, you know, because we had Under the Kudzu, but we also had I'm Going Home to Rock My Baby and Bubba Can Dance and mm-hmm. that type stuff. So anyway, so it was really and I'll Go Down Loving You, which was, man, I loved that song. And anyway, so with that as it is, you know, we moved on and things, you know, continued to work and that's what we did. And now we bring ourselves up to today. And, it was after me being, I left the band in 97 and, you know, from literally got to the point where everybody was burnt out because of the lawsuits and us literally having to work like a bunch of mercenaries, you know, trying to see what we could do about trying to, you know, to keep a living and trying to put money back and that kind of stuff where so much had been taken. Because we'd already spent a couple of $1 million on nothing more than attorney fees. And, you know, you'd get to thinking, man, land sakes, you know, the only reason in the world why we even filed Chapter 11 was to make sure that they you know, they couldn't come get our car. They couldn't come, you know, they couldn't take our house. And this kind of stuff while we're trying to get through all this stuff. And it was really nothing more. We didn't file bankruptcy to get out of anything. We filed bankruptcy to protect ourselves while we paid our bills. That's what Chapter 11 is.
Right.
You know, we didn't, you know, there's other chapters of bankruptcy that you file if you want to just walk away from stuff. We were not wanting to walk away from stuff. We just didn't want anybody, you know, look, our families were at home. We didn't want anybody coming in and you know, I'm trying to make a house payment. What I've got, you know, what equity I've got in my house, I don't want anybody taking it. You know, plus my family's living there, you know, and that's where I go home to and our cars and stuff like that. So therefore, you know, that was a very costly thing. And I literally don't mean monetarily. It was a very costly thing. That was a very stressful time. Not just for us, but, you know, for our wives at that time. And you know, it was just a very, very, you know, touchy time with all that going on.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, you know, being in a band is hard as it is already. Just being in a band and being out on the road and away from family, all the things that are attached to being a musician, all that stuff is difficult. And then add all that other stuff that you didn't sign up for. You know, like that just makes the wick burn a little bit quicker on the candle as far as, you know, all the anxiety and the, you know, all everything that's attached to that, that makes the a little bit more, obviously a lot more stressful, and then puts more pressure on the band dynamics and all that kind of stuff, just because, like, you know, it's stuff that you didn't sign up for.
Well, you know, the thing that that we realized through every bit of that mess is that we love the music and we continued to love the music, but we absolutely got to the point where we detested the business.
Right.
Yeah, and people would say showbiz, man. Showbiz was that was awfully, awfully bad taste in our mouth, you know. And so, therefore, we just befriended radio people that we'd already grown close to. We embraced promoters and people that were putting on events and all that type stuff. And we just did everything in the world we could to just look. This is us, and this is what we do. And we're going to take our band of faithful followers, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to continue to get out here, and we're going to make music. Because that's really what, you know, when it all came down to it, when everybody decided at Robert Burns' house whether we were going to do this or not. I mean, I know I wanted to from the very, very get-go, but the day that everybody decided that we would do it, that's what we did it for, so that we could make music. Because that's what we enjoyed doing together, was making music and making records. Mm-hmm. And trying to create stuff that people would say, man, I love that stuff. You know, and literally the engine behind all of it was literally the times when those times, it's just like the Lord knew when you needed it too. You know, he's always on time anyway. But, you know, it's just kind of like when you needed to hear what you needed to hear, either somebody in the business or somebody out on the road would go, man, You just don't know what y'all's music means to me and my family. Or, man, this song y'all did, man, it spoke volumes to me. And you get to thinking, man, that's what we wanted to do. You know, that's really, we just literally wanted to reach people. You know, we wanted to reach people, have people, you know, just enjoy what we were doing. And to the point that, you know, recognize and realize, and you know, and that even helped with our entertaining people. We were at a fair in West Virginia. I mean, I'm talking about a little old hometown fair that the population probably wasn't 1,800 in this little town, and if it was that in West Virginia, but they had a fair there. And at the end of the night, what we would do is we would go out front, and at the concession table, T-shirts and everything, where they had pictures and stuff, we would set. They'd have tables set up for us, and we would sit down and we'd have people in line, and they would come through the line, and we would autograph pictures or T-shirts or whatever we had, you know, and folks would come through there. And this couple came through and said, I was sitting at the second seat before the end, and Jim Seals was sitting to my left and, or either my right, whichever. I think it was anyway, I was second before the end. And, anyway, so this guy coming through the line said, you know, we didn't make our house payment, you know, this electric payment, whatever it was, said we didn't make our so that we could come and it is house payment, but we didn't make our house payment so that we could come see y'all tonight. And I said, do what now? And I bumped Jim with my elbow, and he said it again. I said, and I turned around to Jim. I said, they were not charging admission. I said, brother, what did you have to? They didn't charge admission for the fair. He goes, no, but they do parking. And I thought, my goodness sakes alive, how much was parking? What, $2 or $3? That night, what that did was that sparked a conversation that literally led off way off into the morning about exactly what we were doing out here. And that was, listen, people that are willing to make the sacrifices of coming to see us, the babysitters that they pay for, the babysitters that they've got to line up and make sure that happens, to leave their children in their care. That's a very, very, you know, you think about that for a minute. That's a very, very strong thing that you're going to do You know, whether you trust the babysitter, you know, surely that's why you would leave them with a sitter. Or maybe it's the mom and dad. But, you know, you're going to leave your children with somebody else while you go off. You know, that's a very strong thing that you realize you do, you know, when you get a babysitter. Well, not only that, you know, what did you do as far as work? I mean, did you leave work early today? I mean, did you have to cut your hours so that you could come to work? Did you miss your house payment? I mean, are things that bad and that tight that you had to miss your house payment so that, you know, you could go? Which only to find out it really actually just wasn't the ticket. You know, he took his wife, you know, for the evening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so therefore they made a night out of coming to see us. So their house payment didn't go lacking just for $2 or $3 for parking. But that's what the occasion was, because we had come to town and this would be a good way to finish up the evening. And so therefore, you know, we started considering all the things that people would do to sacrifice to come see us. And we thought, you know what? We listened to the business tell us what a career date is and what a career date isn't. So what we need to understand is, look, either we're going to go up there and we're going to try to entertain people the best that we absolutely can, or we need to really seriously think about why we should continue doing it. In other words, we need to entertain people to the point that we get them so involved in what's going on with the show that whatever they got going on in their life, that we literally can, you know, if we can, you know, whether it's 60, 75, 90, which now, I mean, we normally do more than 90 minutes. You know, people get to yelling stuff out, you know, from records. And thank goodness we've had some records out after 30-something years that we've been able to play some tunes and people like album cuts and stuff. And if you know, if they yell it out, you know, well, they've had the record and you think, man, they bought the record. That, you know, hey, look, let's do this one, man. We ain't done it in a while, but they're yelling this out. So anyway, so therefore, whether it's, you know, 60, 75, 80, 90, you know, 2 hours, whatever. If you literally can take those people as far away from what's going on in their world for the length of time that you're on the stage and you can remove them from what that is and you get them involved in that show, then at the end of the evening, we did exactly what we were supposed to do wherever it was we went to do it. And what you find out at the end of it, we allowed people to be a part of a show instead of just sitting and witnessing one.
Right.
Now that's true entertainment.
Yeah. Well, it goes to that whole thing of, you know, for example, like those dates you did with Randy Travis. At some point, even if Randy Travis, obviously Randy Travis, a legend, but at some point for even y'all, that becomes a little bit more routine seeing him every night. Those people in the crowd, though, that's like their one night off, you know. And yeah. I always kind of relate it to, you know, that commitment of where they're going to be able to go and have like that water cooler story on Monday or on whatever day, you know, and
yeah.
Tell their buddies about the great time they had or like the specific song performance or whatever the case, because that's the kind of stuff people hang on to.
Yeah. You know, man, you should have been with us Saturday night, man. We went and seen Randy Travis and Shenandoah. And man, I'm telling you, that was one of the best country music shows I have ever been in my life. That's what you strive for. You know, again, it's that what the music means to people, what kind of an exciting night that they had comes from the entertainment. And therefore, when you put that package together and that's what you try to deliver, man, to us, every date is a career date. You know, look, this is a little affair, you know, up there in West Virginia. You ain't got to worry about it. You know, it's just one of those shows that's going on, you know, it's just one of them filler dates. Man, we don't have filler dates. Every show we do, folks come out to listen and folks come out to be entertained. And more than anything else in the world, folks came out. And we owe them something.
I wanted to break really quick to talk about Burn Vodka one last time for a Thomas Mooney's Cocktail Minute. Now, as you know, by no stretch of the imagination am I a mixologist or a seasoned bartender, but here are a few of my favorite go-tos when it comes to Burn Vodka. Now, historically, Burn Vodka has its roots in shots. As you'd expect, around a pre-stage apple, watermelon, or pickle burn shots is like a rite of passage at the Blue Light. In fact, they're necessary for a post-show celebration as well. Now, my favorite also happens to be the easiest to make, the pickle burn. 2 parts pickle juice, 1 part burned vodka. It really is that simple. As Ricky Van Shelton would say, I am a simple man. Now, don't underestimate the possibilities for burn though. This isn't a novelty party shot. Try this one on for size. Let's expand that burn shot into something called a farmer's tan. Take that pickle burn shot and throw it in a bottle of Topo Chico for a new spin on a ranch water. You can throw it over ice, but personally, I just take a swig of the Topo, throw it in the bottle, and you're good to go. Or how about a sunburn? That's 2 ounces of burned vodka, 2 ounces of pineapple juice, 1 ounce mango juice, squeeze in some fresh lime juice, and top it off with a Jamaican-style ginger beer. Telling y'all, that is super refreshing. There's plenty more recipes over on theburnvodka.com, and they consistently add new favorites to the site as well. All right, this has been a Thomas Mooney's Cocktail Minute presented by Burn Vodka. Now let's get back to the episode. I want to go back to what you were mentioning before, you know, like being the band in Muscle Shoals, because I feel like something, and I'm sure it happens still today, it obviously has to happen, but it feels like something very specific to the era of the 80s and 90s is that bands before they got signed already kind of had a little bit more of an establishment, and they had played together some, and they had done something before being signed. For lack of a better term, the paying of the dues, right? Kind of doing stuff like that. And I feel like so much of why there was a more diversity on the radio as far as, you know, some more bluegrass tinged bands, or like a Dwight Yoakam with the California country sound, or people sounding specifically from Texas, whatever the case, I feel like that all has to do with them playing and kind of like finding that sound, finding that pocket of what they wanted to do before, you know, moving to Nashville or moving to Nashville at 18 and just kind of being a blank slate. How important do you think that was for y'all and for that time in general?
Well, you know, I think a good way to explain that as well too. I mean, you explained that really good. I really do think that, you know, I think it's a culmination of, you know, it's people that you've loved their music down through the years. And this is where it was with the group Shenandoah. You know, there was Jim Seals, being the guitar player that he was. You know, Nat, I grew up on bluegrass music and old country stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, the Lefty Frizzell and the Charlie Prides and Ernest Tubbs and stuff like that. So therefore, I was familiar with all the older country music that Jim knew as well. And then he could turn right back around. He could play some Eddie Van Halen stuff, or some Jeff Beck, or Eric Clapton stuff that you'd think that all three of them guys were on stage at that time. I mean, that's just the way Jim rolled. You know, I mean, he literally could do it all. But you know, there was a time that he went from knowing all the older stuff that he got into the Jeff Beck and the Yardbirds and all that other kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and he took it that direction. Well, you turn right back around, there was Ralph. You know, Ralph was always, man, he was a hardcore rock and roll bass player. But he had played on so many sessions, and what was going on in Muscle Shoals at the time was not just, you know, R&B and stuff like that. I mean, there was a lot of country music that in the early 80s had started coming to Muscle Shoals to do records. And therefore, you know, Ralph really got entertained and excited and introduced to a lot of country stuff. So therefore, although he, you know, came from the Black Sabbath, Black Oak, Arkansas, and Ruby Starr and people like that, you know, he's cutting records with Kenny Price, you know, and Archie Kent, you know, some of these guys from Hee Haw. Mm-hmm. And so he's learning all this stuff that, you know, that he had never heard before. And then that stuff, you know, started moving along, and a lot of the writers in town had started writing tunes for other artists to record during the 80s and the 90s. He was playing on the demo session. So therefore, the point that I'm making, every one of us in the band had a different background. You know, the keyboard player played piano with Parliament Funkadelic. I mean, and honest to God, when he said that, I said, what is that? And everybody in the band looked at me like, you don't know who that is? And I thought, no, I don't. Who is it? And they started explaining what all that was. And I got thinking, man, that's, wow. You know, that's more than Xylico. You know, so all of a sudden, you know, and so here are all these different backgrounds. So then when we started creating music together, everybody was coming from a different angle. And before it was all over, we kind of felt like we had found a little void. That we actually, you know, if we were to do this thing, trying to create this stuff in the studio and trying to make this stuff work, you know, if we were to do this thing, and CBS is really going to go gung-ho on it, you know, that might be the avenue right here that we need. You know, nobody else is doing this, nobody else is doing that. And I tell you what, it ain't just a Muscle Shoals thing, the reason why it sounds different. You know, man, this kind of sounds like something that's just different, period. You know, and the next thing you know, we started putting that stuff out, like I said earlier. And then things just started catching on, and we found out from the first record that we had cut, you know, we had done a lot of variety in that record. We'd done more songwriting on that record than we had the ones after that. And the reason why is because we found out what was working. And therefore, when somebody would say, man, I got this tune, you'd say, man, that's what we're looking for. And it didn't make any difference whether we had written it. You know, we got to think, you know, we would rather have a career than being known as songwriters.
Right.
So therefore, that's the reason why we always tried to go for the best songs that we could ever get our hands on. And so therefore, with that as it was, that really, I think, was really part of the due paying. The getting to the point that when the opportunity came around, you were ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
You may not have known you were ready for it, but you were ready for it. And man, bam, you know, it happened. And next thing you know, we got this stuff kind of clicking along, and it was just really a great thing. And it's even to today, you know, gone through the process of Ralph passing away in North Dakota while not working. We had went up there with another band to help them out in a casino gig in North Dakota, where he had died way too young of a heart attack, you know, which that was something that run in his family. His mother died at an early age as well due to, you know, a heart condition. And, man, that was tough. That was a bad time. That really was. You know, we'd lost a brother, you know. And although in 97 I had left the band, still didn't change our brotherhood, you know. Things were just different for everybody, and everybody understood one another. And Stan had left the band first, the keyboard player, and then Ralph left the band. Stan left in 96, Ralph left in 95, Ralph left in 96, and then I left in 97. And I left because it wasn't the same anymore. It didn't, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we got these other guys out here that are playing. They're doing a fantastic job. They're doing great. But, man, this, you know, it's missing. You know, this isn't what we started doing. You know, wasn't where we started out. And, things change. And then you get to thinking through all the stuff that we did and being wore out, you know, get thinking, you know, man, I think all of us are literally burned out. But the thing about it was, Thomas, at that time, you know, if you'd have thought about taking a year off, man, the record label would have dropped you. Man, you know, you don't understand, we're burned out. You know, we're trying to pay lawsuits and trying to, you know, make settlements and stuff like that with acts, you know, man, we've been working, you know, like a bunch of field hands, you know, we're give out. But you mentioned to a label that you're going to take some time off, and they're going to tell you, look, you need to get out here and work this record. You know, you take time off, you know, you may as well come back and look for another record. Like, well, to do your bid. So we knew good and well that wasn't going to work. So anyway, so we just kind of muscled through it. But you know, and this all sounds like a downer, what I've been telling you, but to be honest with you, nothing could have been more re-satisfying in so many different ways, or gratifying, because what it did was it literally made each and every one of us feel like that's who we had. Mm-hmm. We had one another. And what we had made out of the music was what we had done with one another. And everybody was in place, and everybody was doing it. And it was us that did it. And it wasn't a management. It wasn't even the record producers. And you know what? It wasn't the record labels either. You know, we had the opportunity to do it. They just provided the opportunity and the means and the wheels to get us there on the track. And man, that was a wonderful thing for us to go through. We all hated it, but it was a wonderful thing to go through, because it brought us even closer than what we ever dreamed or fathomed. And then when Ralph left, when Stan left, when I left, it wasn't one of them things, you know, them guys broke up because they hated one another. Man, nothing could have been further from the truth. You know, a lot of the, you know, missing ball games and not being able to go to school plays and a lot of that stuff with our kids, you know, a lot of that started coming into play because, like I said, you know, we were working like mercenaries, you know, to try to get all this settled. And I think when we finally got all of it taken care of and settled, and then we got into the other record deal and we started working it, I think it just started catching up with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I've talked with a few other bands from this era, and I think you can look at, even just in general in the music business, we've lost so many great artists at early ages. And I wonder how much of it had to do with just being on the road nonstop. And, you know, like you mentioned, like, you know, this Shenandoah busting up probably like earlier than all of y'all anticipated, but it all probably had to do with also just being on the road and just all those, the stress of being overworked. And I think you can see that in a lot of other bands too. I'm sure you've talked with other folks in country music who have been, you know, doing the band thing, like Restless Heart, yeah, or anyone like that. They busted up earlier than I think they ever anticipated, all these different bands, because of the aspect of being overworked, not being able to just have that little bit of a break, that pause. And
yeah,
you know, you wonder, like, had like y'all not been driven to be overworked, y'all would have probably just kept on going the whole time, you know?
Yeah. And you know what? Every one of us has said that too. You know, everyone, and you know, and everybody goes, well, you know, so that mean the other two guys, you know, they didn't do, no, you know, tell you the truth, the other two guys quit too. Mm-hmm. You know that, you know, because, you know, when the interviews are done and stuff like that, and that's the kind of order as it was as the band left, well, then Mike and Jim, you know, they quit too. And to tell you the truth, you know, they would even tell you that, you know what, that Honest and Truly was the best thing in the world that we did do. Man, we got away from it for a while. You know, and you know, because I think everybody, you know, needs to get their batteries recharged. In fact, right, that's even a biblical principle. You know, the Lord said, come up here and rest before ye come apart. That literally is a biblical principle. You know, it's a very important thing to get rest, you know,
mm-hmm,
and to, yeah, try to keep your mind and your focus on what you're doing. Because I think everybody just benefits from it, you know.
Right. I've talked with people that they've mentioned this too, and this is maybe some of the stuff that, you know, the average person really doesn't think about. Obviously, you know, you cutting the record, being on tour, that's the work, and that's also some, you're getting some kind of benefit out of that, as far as like getting those creative juices flowing, performing, all that kind of stuff that's attached to those 60, 92 hour gigs, plus all the time in the studio. That's all probably part that you don't even really think about being hard, but it's all like just the travel, the wear and tear. It's the, I know definitely back during the 90s, you know, doing all like waking up early and doing all these like radio tour dates,
yeah,
all that kind of, like all the other stuff that you didn't necessarily think is like work, you know, but like that it gets added on. And like all of a sudden, yeah, all your free time gets just eaten away.
Yeah. You know, and see, I was the one that was doing that, you know, because I was a front guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody said, man, they don't talk to us. They always hand the mic to you. You know, so, you know, man, you go do it. You know, so it was one of those kind of things. And you know, and you're doing, you know, not only that, you know, you're at a show, you pull into town, and there's a field rep for the label. He's there with the car. He's going to get you off the bus and carry you to a couple of radio stations. You're going to go do interviews. And then he's going to bring you, you know, and you're going to wind up doing another, you know, Midtown station or a heavy hitter or a mom and pop and that kind of stuff. And that's what your day consisted of, you know, and which, you know, that I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't give anything in the world for it. Because to be honest with you, when it was all over with, said and done, even back during the time when I was telling you about when all this stuff was coming to a screeching halt over the lawsuits and this kind of stuff, man, the radio guys, they still kept pounding the records.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they kept playing, and you know, here's my buddies and stuff like that. And you go by and see them, man. You know, man, how's everything going? Man, is this getting worked out? Yeah, and what we found. And we found a friendship and a kinship with those guys, you know, that literally was unbelievable. In fact, you know, the record labels that we had signed with said, man, you guys in radio, man, I mean, are y'all doing something at radio that somebody else is not doing? And the only thing that we would know is that, you know, we just always tried to make sure that we included them.
Right.
You know, somebody would say, well, man, I just came to show. No, man, introduce us tonight, man. No, man, I can't do that. Yeah, you can. Man, get up here and just introduce us, man. That'd be killer. Well, what I say, you know, I say, you know, what, just say Shenandoah, the CBS Records, Shenandoah RCA Records, CBS, Shenandoah Capitol Records, you know. And here they are, you know, from Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Just, you know, and before you know it, you know, we had relationships like that. And man, wouldn't give anything in the world for it. You know, and still to this day, although some of them are, you know, not at radio anymore, you know, they're doing other things. We still friends, still got their telephone numbers, you know, and see that's really what all this is about. It's about whether you, and I know this sounds like I'm fixing to start planting flowers and we're going to sit around and sing Kumbaya, but I'm serious. I'm not kidding you, Thomas. It's kind of, I mean, why did you get into it for? I mean, was relationships and finding people that you could befriend and literally, you know, trying to find some lifelong friends and stuff like that you actually had relationships with that you knew good and well that you were in the music business, they were in the music business, and you had some ties and stuff like that. And when you came to town, whether they were in the record business or not, you had them come out to the show and bring their family and that kind of stuff. And you still got a relationship with those people. And before it was all over, when we befriended people, they knew it wasn't because, oh, them guys just want us to play their records. I mean, these guys, you know, they genuinely like us because we genuinely like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so therefore that's the best way in the world I think anybody could ever do, you know, trying to have a relationship with them. Man, get to know them.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you on all that. One of the things that I think people always loved about y'all, and I know it's one of those things that I loved, is like you guys had what I would kind of call a good mix of ballads, you know what I mean? And then also like the up-tempo kind of, you know, Church on Cumberland Road kind of up-tempo stuff, the fun stuff that was, you know, just like a good radio tune. And what was that like, I guess, like picking those songs as far as like finding those right songs that spoke to y'all, that you knew that you guys wanted to add to y'all sound? And also like just keeping that balance of, again, like some of those, you know, those heart tugging ballads of, you know, Ghosts in This House or like, I don't know, like, The Moon Over Georgia, you know, stuff like that. That was, what was that like? I guess like finding that balance of those songs.
Or I Want to Be Loved Like That. You know, mm-hmm. That, you know, that's the same thing. That man, that's a great segue into the new album now, because you know we wrote a tune with Dallas Davis and Mike McGuire and myself. We wrote a tune called if I can make it till summertime. You know, and it's just, I mean, it's one of those, I mean, it's flam bam, and I mean, it's one of those driving little tunes, I mean, right out of the gate. You know, I've been swinging this hammer in the freezing, driving rain. It just, another 2 months, she's going to be mine to claim. I've been saving every penny, every dollar I make. Come on, Father Time, for July's sake. If I can make her mine, I'll make her mine if I can make it till summertime. And it's one of those charging like a church on Cumberland Road. Mm-hmm. And then we turn right back around and had the opportunity of doing a record with Ashley McBride. I love Ashley McBride. I love her sense. I love, you know, her aura about herself. I really love, you know, her vocals and stuff like that. And we did a tune that's called If Only. And it's another one of those songs like you're talking about. It's one of those songs that really hits you. And then the more you think about it, the more you get to thinking, man, land sakes, man, you know, if only, man, if only, you know, it's the kind of stuff that tells a really wonderful story. The brand new single that we've got out now with us and Blake Shelton, Then a Girl Walks In. Man, what a literally perfect depiction of exactly what happens. You know, here you are. Man, you're living on the edge of the world. Everything you got, when dollar beers are worth every cent, you and your boys five deep in a two bedroom parking lot view, sleep until noon, doing what you want to do. Man, you're high on life, and life can't get any better. And then a girl walks in, and she doesn't ruin it. she just made everything happen.
Right.
You know, and it's that same type thing. The next thing you know you can't live without her. The next thing you know, there's no way in the world you're going to live the rest of your life without her. And the next thing you know, you're marrying. And the next thing you know, you're going to have children. And all of a sudden, then the child comes along. It's a little old bitty girl. And then that girl walks in. And you know, one day you're going to have to give her up and you can't stand it. Then a girl walks in. Because when that happens, you know, that true love has popped you right between the eye. And you can't go anywhere with it. I mean, you can't move because that's where you are. And that's the kind of the songs that we've always tried to do everything in the world we could to try to get our hands on. What was tunes that literally, would say something to somebody, that it would be a lyric that would paint such an absolutely wonderful picture. The tune we did with Zach Brown Band. I'll take another one of those. A day with my granddaddy in his old Skeeter boat, a sack of bologna sandwiches and two old fishing poles. I'd take another one of those. Man, you can look back, and I'd give anything in the world if me and my granddaddy could go fishing again. You know, he's gone on, of course, but and that's what the song says, you know. And then, like little things in the song that really makes you really know that you really appreciate the relationship that you're in. You know, those I love yous when she hangs up the phone, I'd take another one of those. You know, and it's just, it's tunes like that I think that really minister to people's spirits. I think it says something to them. I think it drives them to the point that they want to listen harder. And, man, that's just, you know, that's a good way to conduct a record for people to listen from top to bottom. But it's even better. What I was telling you earlier, man, when you look out over the crowd and you see people sing the lyrics to Two Dozen Roses, and you're watching, you know, 17 and 18 year old kids. I mean, our career in the music business, as they would say, was over before these kids were ever even born. And then all of a sudden, now you're playing and singing in front of, and they're singing every lyric. You know, it's amazing. You get to thinking, man, how do they know that? And then you find out by talking with them and stuff like that. So, man, my mom and dad, you know, we used to get, man, they had some cassettes of y'all's, and then we had some CDs of y'all's. Man, we would listen to them CDs and stuff like that. So, man, we're going to soccer practice, we're going to baseball games, man, we on a road trip on vacation, man, they'd pop that CD, and man, we'd listen to y'all all the way to Florida. You know, and you get to thinking, man, wow. And then again, you go back to what we were talking about earlier, Thomas, and you get to thinking, land sakes alive. You know, that's exactly, man, we honest and truly, we did we honestly truly did want to make an impact on people's lives. And then you start realizing what the impact meant, and you realize those songs that had the strength in it, the production that has the strength in it, the little things that made them like those songs, you know, the little licks that you put in there, the little vocal licks that you put in there, the harmonies, where the harmonies went, and, you know, and what they said, you know, those kind of things, you know, you get to thinking, that's unbelievable, you know?
Right. You know, maybe this is amazing to you as well. I kind of go back to the whole, you know, let's just go back to you guys being the house band and you guys, you know, covering songs that are big hits that are from your childhood. I'm sure you were cutting or playing some songs that were
staples. So
now Two Dozen Roses is that, like, every house band, every up and coming band, I guarantee you at one point that's like in their set list when they're first starting out.
Yeah. And I understand that. It's hard to believe. I mean, it really is, but you know, me and Merle Haggard had the opportunity of chatting one time and I said, you know, Merle, I said, you know, you can't go anywhere to listen to dance music without hearing a Merle Haggard tune. Mm-hmm. And he said, son, he said, look, he said, you know, it's the same way when I was growing up. He said, man, you couldn't go anywhere without listening to Bob Wills. I mean, there's folks that was playing Bob Wills music, even folks that even realized what Western swing was. You know, folks loved Bob Wills, you know, out there where I grew up. And of course, a lot of people think he's from Oklahoma. He was born in California. And anyway, his folks were from Muskogee, Oklahoma, and around there. But anyway, he was from Oildale, California, out by Bakersfield, and he said, you know, man, that, you know, the stuff that was on the radio, you know, where I grew up was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. You know, he said, you grew up listening to that stuff, and he said, you'd go out anywhere, and man, that's what people do, but nobody could do it like the original. And he said, man, the first time I ever seen Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys play, he said, son, that changed my life forever. It changed me, you know. Mm-hmm. He said, man, I literally would run away from home to try to chase that, you know. And that, man, you get to thinking that somebody's, so deep rooted in what the music did to them, that it means that much, that they literally want to take the rest of their livelihood, of everything that they are, and invest who they are into that. You know, and you think about that for a minute, you get to thinking, man, that's the reason why a lot of times when people go, man, you know, what do you think about, you know, my boy wants to get into the music business. Now, is your boy or your daughter here? Yeah, but, you know, man, go get them and man, let's chat. And the first thing that I'll always tell them, look, you know, how much do you love the music? Oh, man, I love it. It means the world to me. Well, that's what it's going to take. You got to be committed. In fact, you got to want it more than anybody else wants it. So therefore that's kind of where you got to be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, that has to be something a little bit on the, as you said right there just a minute ago about, you know, all these kids knowing Two Dozen Roses and, I'm quoting you on this one, you know, our career was over before they were born. Now, obviously, like, this new record, these are all with, like, a lot of new artists. And, you know, obviously, they weren't born after Two Dozen Roses. But what is that kind of like? Is there some reassurance for you as far as knowing and understanding that, like, all these up-and-coming and established artists who are from this era of music are, you know, they want to cut songs with y'all and do a record that way?
Yeah, you know, I would say that honest and truly, Thomas, that was profound. It really was. You know, when I was making those calls to these cats, I got to thinking, you know, man, this is probably going to be like pulling teeth, man. Let me think for a minute, you know, how I want to approach this. Because, man, these cats are at Current Radio right now. You know, man, why in the world do they want to, you know, team up with a bunch of has-beens? And, you know, try to see what, you know, you know, see how they can get out of a conversation by being gracefully enough to say no. And you know, and I'm serious, but I'm not kidding you. And then all of a sudden, talk to Brad Paisley. Brad was the first one on, and went and done a thing for his wife. His wife does a show every year there at the Wild Horse in Nashville. And so they, you know, they asked, would we be in India? Yeah, man, we'd love it. And so while there, I got to telling Brad, I said, you know, this kind of, you know, we got this idea going. And I said, man, I said, would you consider doing, and I didn't even get done with it before he said, being on a record with y'all. And I said, yeah. And he said, man, I would love that. He said, just tell me when and what tune is it? And I said, well, I mean, okay. I mean, if I found a tune and stuff like this, you know, could run it by and see, unless you got something or, you know, see what we got. Because before it was all over with, I found out that a lot of these people were such big fans that it wasn't like pulling teeth at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was kind of like it literally was overwhelming, you know, some of the things that they would say, man, you don't even know. Man, y'all's music was my childhood. Man, I grew up, you know, with the Joe Diffies, and I grew up with the Restless Hearts and the Shenandoahs. Man, y'all were it, you know. And man, if you're kidding me, and Blake, you know, there was Blake, and we knew that Blake was a fan, but then all of a sudden he gets on The Voice, and for the past 6 years, he's had a Shenandoah tune on there. He's had somebody from Team Blake doing a Shenandoah tune every year. And so anyway, so we approached Blake, and I told Blake, I said, look, man, you know, you could do this tune by yourself. You don't even need a song. This is a Blake Shelton tune. And it was really kind of funny because when he agreed to do it, we were at the CMA, and he was going backstage. He was fixing to go out and entertain. He to go out on stage to sing. And I kind of, I'm not saying I chased him down, but I was in the hall and in the corridor, and I got, hey, Blake, man, are you going to do this record with us or not? And he goes, yeah, because I'd seen him a couple texts. Of course, he was busy, and he told me he'd get back with me. But I thought, you know, hey, look, it ain't no text. I'm just asking. He said, yeah, man, I'm going to do it. He said, send me the tune. I said, what? He goes, send me the tune. And I said, okay, cool. And he said, and tell Narbel, have your manager call Narbel and tell him I'm in. And that's literally how we made the deal. And the next thing you know, man, he finished up what he was doing in California. He went back to Oklahoma, and in the studio, you know, we literally sent an engineer out there. We got the vocal on it and brought it back, and he sang that from top to bottom 6 times. And said, man, just put it together, see what you want to do with it, you know, whatever, you know. And all I asked him to do, I said, you know, Blake, if you'll just start singing at the second verse, do the chorus that follows. And then, you know, if you'll do, you know, the bridge. And then that way, you know, we can splice up. I mean, you can, you know, split back and forth, you know, we can trade off the lyric. And the next thing you know, he sends six takes back from top to bottom. He sang the whole song 6 times. You know, and just, man, just a peach of a guy, you know, mm-hmm. And, you know, and you could tell that, man, he literally went the extra mile. And then, you know, we did a show we were in Wisconsin, and we were doing a show and Lady Annabella, well, Lady A was coming on after we were a little bit later on that evening. Well, they all, I mean, everyone, I mean, the road crew, everybody from Lady A's bunch was out there on the stage listening. Just do the show at the Hodag. And I mean, there was folks literally all over that hillside. I mean, just all over the place, you know, for the entertainment that day. And so anyway, so, you know, we were doing the thing, and man, it was just one of those days when everybody was hitting on all 8 cylinders. I mean, man, it was just clicking along. Man, you know, the band's into it. The crowd's into it. I mean, the crowd's singing along. You got 25,000 people that are out there just, man, they're singing at the top of their lungs, and You know, you get to the end of the show and you hold that mic out and they're yelling, "Get me to the church on the Cumberland Road." And you listen to this, the show ends up and they're yelling for more and this kind of stuff. And Charles walks up to me and said, "Man, I hate it. I'm going to be a geek, man. But I got to gurn you, man. I got to get a picture with you and I want you to meet my boy." I said, "Man, I have loved y'all ever since I was a kid. I've loved y'all." And before it was all over, we got to talking. We got to, you know, sharing numbers and got to texting one another and calling one another. And so when this came around, you know, I said, "Man, look, I'm going to call Charles and see if Lady A will be a part of this." And so, Charles said, "Man, we got this tune that we wrote. I send it to you and let's see what happens." And next thing you know, they sent it. And, "Every Time I Look at You" was on the record. Because, man, by the time they got to the chorus on that demo, I said, "Fellas, this stuff right here will make you pay bills you don't even owe." I said, "Man, we've got to do this one." And of course, them writing it, and stuff, management, said, "Man, yeah." So they're in. I said, "Man, they are in like Flint." And, it was those kind of things. But, you don't realize that. And it's the same thing, Thomas, when somebody go, "Man, you know, them guys are living legends." You get to thinking, no, man, the living legends were the Merle Haggards and the George Jones and the Vern Godstons and the Kitty Wells and the Ernest Tubbs and people like that. That's who the legends are. And then you get to thinking that people look at you that way as well too. And you get to thinking, man, that's unbelievable. But I guess it also goes along with, you never believe that you're as old as you are. You think your children age, and you start seeing your children turn into be boys, and from boys you start seeing them turn into be young men, and then you start seeing them turn into be fathers. And you look at them and you've seen how they age, but you don't think that you did. And then you look in the mirror and you realize that you did as well, but in your heart and your spirit you didn't.
Right. Yeah. I love that right there. Because I think like it's passing of time is just such a weird thing. Because yeah, you sometimes don't realize how much time has passed and it just goes so quickly. And, I think there has to be something to also about how a lot of y'all don't believe, like that whole living legend part that you're saying, even though y'all are, it's the being humble and still like knowing that you guys are still just that hardworking band as you ever were, even though you guys aren't, you guys are legendary just all the same.
Yeah. Well, it is that, that's kind of a, it's like when you get around anybody and anybody goes to bragging on you too much, it makes you feel uncomfortable.
Right. I hear you.
it does, it's just kind of like, I appreciate, no, man, you think, okay. And it's not, Lord forbid, you certainly wouldn't want to ever hurt anybody's feelings, but you also got to remember, look, that sometimes people don't want a thing in the world from you, Thomas. The only thing in the world that they want to do, they just want an opportunity just to say what they feel. Man, you'll never believe what this song, man, I heard the song Mama Knows, and you don't know this, but man, my mom died and I wasn't there when she passed away. And man, when I heard that lyric in that song, man, it literally brought me back to that. And it's kind of like what you Presswood said in the song remembers when. Mm-hmm. And that really truly is the truth. I mean, songs do that for people, and if you can do whatever you can do, and if you can invest what you've done in your life, and you can make that work, and you can make that happen, and it winds up being invested in somebody else's life, then that literally has what it's literally. You've moved people, and the great thing about music, that's exactly what it does. It moves people, whether up or down. It's powerful. And that's exactly what it does. It moves people. And, whether you get a chance to do this for 50, 40, 20, 10, 5 years, 60 years, whatever. Man, I'm literally in so in awe of Willie Nelson.
Right.
And here's Willie, man, his health is not good, but it won't stop him. And the reason why it won't stop him is because that's who he is. You know, and every time, and what you realize, everything, that's who Willie Nelson is. And that's what he's always been. And although he didn't have the years in front of him when you seen him, or the years behind him when you seen him, you realize, you know, whatever it took, that's who that guy is. You know, and it's a wonderful thing. But man, I just want to tell you, Thomas, it's been absolutely great chatting with you. I feel like you really hadn't got the opportunity to ask any questions, you know, maybe that you wanted answered. No, maybe have the opportunity to maybe get the chance to do this on another occasion. But man, I sure do appreciate your time. And more than anything, I appreciate your ear for just letting me just dump all that in there.
All right, that is it for this one. Huge thanks to Marty for the conversation. Y'all be sure to go over and check out Every Road by Shenandoah. Stop on over at the Neon Eon merch store and order yourself a t-shirt or two. Go visit our exclusive presenting partners, Burn Vodka, while you're at it. Subscribe, like, share, and so on. All right, I'll see y'all next time around here at the Neon Eon.